book on the Lee family, the Lee girls, the title of it, about 20 years ago. And when it hit the market, it was unlike anything else that had ever appeared. And I think it's still selling very well today. Am I right, Ms. Cowling? I think so. It sure seems to be. It's a very popular topic, a popular subject in one of the most famous men of America. I know she also wrote another biography, which to my shame I have not read, Margaret Duncan Preston, but I plan to soon. And of course, that's another local topic. I don't know what else I can say that will enhance her reputation. I don't think I can say anything. She's an expert on the Lee family, in particular the women in Robert E. Lee's life, and I think her talk will speak for itself. So if you will, I'd like for you to give her a big Lexington welcome.
I see a lot of familiar faces out there, and glad to see all of you here. I'm always interested at how nearly everything written about Robert E. Lee is viewed from his perspective. Today, I'd like for us to look at some of the women Lee cared about most, women almost obscured by his long shadow in history, to try to see what their view of the man must have been. I hope that by going through this exercise, we will come out with a truer view, not only of the women involved, but of Lee himself, as seen through their eyes. The most important woman in Lee's early life was, of course, his mother, the beautiful Ann Carter, who had defied her father's wishes and insisted on marrying a man 17 years her senior, the glamorous but improvident Light Horse Harry Lee. Within 2 weeks of her marriage, according to family members, she had come to regret her decision. By the time she found herself pregnant with her fifth child, the first baby, Algernon Sidney Lee, had died at the age of 16 months. Ann Lee had lost most of her romantic ideas about marriage and motherhood. A few months before Robert's birth, she wrote to her sister-in-law, commiserating that Elizabeth Collins Lee was also about to give birth. "You have my best wishes for your success, my dear," Anne wrote to Elizabeth, "and truest assurance that I do not enjoy your prospects nor wish to share in them." However, days after the baby was born, his mother was able to write Elizabeth cheerfully that she had a third son, a little black-eyed brown boy, very healthy, good-tempered, lively, and very sweet. The child had made his arrival at Stratford, the Lee family plantation, but as you know, probably by the time the little fellow was three, Ann Lee had moved her family to Alexandria, in part to escape her husband's creditors, in part to provide a more hospitable environment in which to rear and educate her children. Before long, there was still another little Lee, a daughter named Catherine Mildred, now five living children for Ann Lee to care for on the meager trust fund her father had bequeathed to her. Somehow she managed to find time to teach Robert his catechism before he could learn to read, and she made sure that the child not only recited the answers to the Reverend William Meade, the Episcopal clergyman in Alexandria, but that he also got to know that gentleman. It was to be a friendship that lasted until the middle of the Civil War, when Robert and the dying old bishop met one last time. "Of all the men I have ever known," Robert mused, "I consider him the purest." Though she was busy with a multitude of tasks, Anne seems to have found time to teach Robert his earliest studies as well. Then she sent him away to attend a Carter family school held in the home of her own sister, Elizabeth Carter Randolph, in Fauquier County. Few of these decisions about the boy's education seem to have been shared with Henry Lee, who was still involved in land speculation, in trying to escape his creditors, and in trying to sell his memoirs of the war in the Southern Department of the United States. Though Robert was now away from his mother's oversight, Anne remained concerned about his deportment, and she wrote to Mrs. Randolph to learn if the child were difficult to manage. That lady replied that though she had no indication of trouble with the lad, she would advise Anne to pursue the policy she herself had long used for her own sons, whip and pray, pray and whip. There is no record of whether or not Mrs. Lee followed Elizabeth Randolph's advice. By the time Robert returned home to continue his schooling at the Alexandria Academy, his father had left America, bound for the Barbados, in search of health and to escape his hounding creditors. Unhappy in his exile, he died on the way home on an island off the coast of Georgia. Robert was only 11 years old. His older brother, Carter, was a student at Harvard. The next brother, Smith, was about to leave for a career in the Navy. The elder sister, Anne Kinlock, had become seriously ill and had to seek medical treatment in Philadelphia, eventually losing one arm, probably to tuberculosis. And little Mildred was only 7 years old. Almost by default, then, Anne Carter Lee, already in declining health, relied on her sturdy youngest son, both for companionship and for health in maintaining the household. It fell to Robert to handle the family finances, supervise the servants, see that his mother got out for rides in her carriage, and in general, keep the family functioning. Contemporary records indicate that within a year of his father's death, Robert became, quote, the keeper of the keys, shopping with a family basket to purchase daily supplies of fruit, vegetables, meats, and staples. One cannot help wondering whether the ailing mother worried that she was putting too much adult responsibility upon the shoulders of this youngest son. How much did she confide in him about her disappointments in marriage and her continuing financial situation? Even as a lively youngster full of fun and with many friends, the boy seems to have learned from his mother and her unhappy situation a lifelong lesson about the horrors of debt and an ironclad sense of honor and duty. By 1823, Robert was 16 and had completed his studies at the Alexandria Academy, and Anne Lee began thinking about how she could educate him further. Much of the income from the trust her father left her had been used up in educating Charles Carter at Harvard. Smith's profession had already been decided by his joining the Navy. So what could she now do for Robert? There seems to have been some speculation about his going into medicine or the church. But a medical career required long schooling, well beyond her means. And the lad, though he was conscientious in learning his catechism and attending church with her, seemed less committed to the personal religious devotion she might have wished for him. That left a military career. One wonders if Anne Lee had reservations about her youngest son following in his father's footsteps. Still, there seemed little alternative. If she could manage to get an appointment for the boy at West Point, his education would be free. And then there was also the possibility that young Robert himself was eager to redeem his father's reputation by becoming a soldier. Garnering that appointment was not an easy task. Relying on personal friendships and willing to use her husband's revolutionary reputation, Anne managed to get an impressive array of endorsing letters for Robert. Then came the long wait. Finally, he received a letter of acceptance, but not for another year. It must have been a bitter disappointment to both mother and son, though it did give Anne Lee another 12 months in which to enjoy his support and company. When it was time to leave home for good, she explained to a relative, "You know what I have lost. He is son, daughter, and everything to me." Though her health was sadly and steadily declining, Anne Lee was buoyed by his letters home and by his one furlough in Alexandria between his second and third years at West Point. She was delighted to learn in 1827 that he was made an assistant to the mathematics professor at the academy, a position that gives him, she wrote, $10 a month in addition to his regular allowance. By the time Robert graduated from West Point as a second lieutenant in June of 1829, Anne Lee was dying after many years of suffering, probably from tuberculosis. Too ill to stay in the rented house she had occupied for so long in Alexandria, she accepted the offer to move to the home of a close friend, distant cousin, and benefactor, William Henry Fitzhugh, and his wife, Mariah. It was at Ravensworth, then, several miles west of Alexandria, that young Robert found his mother. There was little he could do for her now, except hold her hand and mix her medicines. A friend remembered how she watched Robert's every move and seemed content only when he was in the room. She died on the morning of July the 26th, 1829. The children buried her at Ravensworth, where the Fitzhughs could tend her grave and keep her memory alive. In her will, Anne Lee left something to each of her children: household linens, personal belongings, and a few slaves to her daughters, some land in southwest Virginia, several other slaves, and what remained of her trust to her boys. By the time everything was settled, each of the boys received about $3,000. It wasn't much. Her intangible legacy was far more permanent, an extraordinary example of determination, self-respect, unwillingness to exhibit self-pity, a sincere and steadfast belief in a personal God, and a firm resolve to promote as much as she could a better life for her children. She had not wanted that third son, but Robert had meant everything in the world to her. The next woman I'd like us to look at briefly is Mrs. George Washington Custis Lee, the sister of William Henry Fitzhugh, who was so very kind to Robert's mother, and a woman who was to become Robert E. Lee's mother-in-law. Mary Fitzhugh had been born and reared at Chatham on Virginia's northern neck. At the age of 16, she married George Washington Parke Custis, the step-grandson and legal heir of George Washington. Custis was a likable but thoroughly impractical man, who spent years building an enormous house high on the Virginia Bluffs, which he called Arlington, designed not only as a home for a future wife and progeny, but also as a repository for the many mementos he had inherited from Mount Vernon. When the Custises were married, only one wing of the huge structure was complete, and throughout most of Mrs. Custis's life, the middle portion of the house remained unfinished. In the first 5 years of her marriage, Mary Fitzhugh Custis gave birth to four children, all but one of whom died in infancy. The sole survivor was a girl, Mary Anna Randolph, born in 1808. A pious, bright, capable, but unpretentious woman, Mrs. Custis knew Robert's mother, as all kinfolk did in that part of Virginia. She had watched the boy growing up. She knew of his stellar record at West Point, and she appreciated his care and concern for his invalid mother. So she could not have been unhappy when the handsome, upright young man began to come calling upon her much-loved and much-petted daughter, Mary. It was Mrs. Custis who arranged one summer evening in 1830, while staying at Chatham, to leave Mary and the visiting Robert alone together. And when Mary came out from the tete-a-tete to announce that Robert had proposed marriage, Mrs. Custis enlisted enthusiastically in his cause. "I am glad Robert comes from such a loving family," she stated. Mr. Custis was far less happy about the match. He knew all too well about Light Horse Harry's indebtedness and his whispered infidelities. He also knew about the scandal involving Robert's half-brother, Black Horse Harry, who had seduced his sister-in-law and ward, an indiscretion that had resulted in an illegitimate child. George Washington Parke Custis also recognized that despite Robert Lee's fine record at the Academy, the lowly lieutenant would have few financial resources in a peacetime army that promised meager pay and slow promotions. It is significant that when Robert confided to his brother Charles Carter about his engagement, he wrote, "I am engaged to Miss Mary C. That is, she and her mother have given consent." After the anxious father was persuaded to accede to the marriage and the couple were wed in June of 1831, Mrs. Custis continued her warm relationship with Robert Lee as she opened her heart and her home to him and to the seven children that came along between 1832 and 1846. For the rest of his life, Robert E. Lee regarded Mrs. Custis as his mother, and she became a substitute parent for him as long as she lived. She wrote him long letters about the family when he was away from Virginia, and she proffered advice about the education of her grandchildren. Only once did she appear to disagree with him seriously, when she and Mr. Custis urged Robert to give up his military career to come back to Arlington to manage the estate. When she died unexpectedly in 1853, Lee was deeply moved. "She was to me all a mother could be," he wrote, "and I yield to none in my admiration for her character, love for her virtues, and veneration for her memory." Mrs. Custis had been his champion for many years. She had aided him in his pursuit of her daughter. She had been a loving and kindly grandmother to his children, and she remained his warm and generous-minded mother-in-law for 23 years. In reality, he became the son she never had. Of course, the most important woman in Robert E. Lee's life was his wife, Mary Anna Randolph Custis Lee. Biographers have had a great deal to say on the subject of this famous marriage between one of the handsomest men in America to a young woman whose countenance is often called plain. Douglas Southall Freeman wrote that Lee's marriage to Mary Custis was one of the major influences that shaped his career, one that strengthened his self-control and made him the representative of the family of the founder of American liberty. But there's no mention of love. While Thomas Connolly was sure that Robert Lee was perhaps as much enamored of Arlington as he was of Mary. Nobody really understands why people fall in love or why they make the decision to undertake the adventure of marriage. Mary Custis was unquestionably a young woman whose family connections Robert Lee's own mother would have approved of. After all, she was the step-granddaughter of George Washington. That would have been important. Also, probably feeling very orphaned after the recent loss of his own mother, Robert Lee must have felt warmed and welcomed by Mrs. Custis's hospitality. And most significant, it was quite obvious to all who knew young Mary Custis that she was very much in love with Robert Lee. He was well aware as Mr. Custis, that he had little to recommend him except the character of his mother and his own ambitions. To be so deeply appreciated and loved by a girl about his own age, a bright, lively, articulate young woman who was well-educated and interested in the arts and the political scene around her, a girl whose depth of love and family stability seemed to promise the kind of enveloping security he yearned for. All these factors may well have compensated for any lack of outward beauty. Even her simple piety and that of her mother may have struck a chord in his heart, as they surely reminded him of his mother's own religious convictions. And how did Mary Custis view Robert Lee during these days of courtship? She seems to have given her heart unreservedly to the young Army lieutenant, probably not thinking about what marriage and the move away from home might mean. Though Robert told one of his West Point fellow graduates that he would not be unmarried for all you could offer me, and Mary spoke feelingly of her tender and affectionate husband, The couple had their share of disagreements early on. He complained about his wife's poor housekeeping and her habitual tardiness. Mrs. L. is sometimes addicted to laziness and forgetful in her housekeeping, he wrote in 1834. He shouldn't have been surprised, because at Arlington there was a lack of cleanliness and a general air of inefficiency often commented upon by visitors. Mary seems to have had little training in housekeeping or management, perhaps because her mother was herself too capable or perhaps too indulgent to teach Mary well. When complaints didn't work, Robert did his best to change his wife's tardiness through humor. "I never knew him late," one of their sons remembered years later. "He used to appear some minutes before the rest of us, and would chide my mother gently, in a playful way, and with a bright smile." Nothing in Mary Lee's letter shows that she resented his comments. Instead, she seems to have simply ignored them. She never became as good a housekeeper as Lee would have wished, and she remained always late. A more serious criticism had to do with his wife's frequent absences. In the early months of her marriage, Mary Lee found herself desperately homesick for Arlington. "What would I give for one stroll on the hill of Arlington," she wrote her mother. More often than suited Robert, she found reasons to return home to the plantation. Her health was never robust, and it's quite possible that during one of those early long stays at home, Mary Custis Lee was experiencing morning sickness, because by 1832 she was pregnant with her first child. Finally, after Robert issued an ultimatum, "I can't consent to your remaining longer than the 1st of June," she returned to the army quarters at Fort Monroe. The birth of their first child, George Washington Custis Lee, that August, appears to have pasted over those early frictions. When Robert was assigned to work at the War Office in Washington, the family returned cheerfully to Arlington, where by now Mr. Custis, delighted with his namesake, had become thoroughly reconciled to Robert Lee as a son-in-law. Lee was away surveying the boundary between Ohio and the territory of Michigan when his second child and first daughter, Mary Custis Lee, was born in the summer of 1835. Though she seems to have delivered the baby without incident, Mary Lee developed severe afterbirth complications with general soreness and huge abscesses on the insides of her thighs that may have been brought about by inadequate sterile technique at delivery. When the painful lesions refused to heal, the young mother wrote in desperation to her husband, begging him to come home to take care of her. This must have been the first major crisis in their 4 years of marriage. To be sure, she had spent more time at Arlington than he might have wished before baby Boo was born. But he knew she was proud to be an Army wife, and he assumed she understood that if he were to be a success in his profession, he could not get leave whenever he wished or whenever the family asked him to. Perhaps judging Mary's recovery this time by her relatively easy recuperation after Custis's birth, Lee replied in terms that seem harsh and unfeeling. "Why," he wrote, "do you urge my immediate return and tempt one in the strongest manner to endeavor to get excused from the performance of a duty imposed upon me by my profession?" No, he told her, he would not panic and ask for early leave. Instead, he urged his Molly to cheer up and pack up, to lay aside unavailing regrets, and to meet with a smiling face and cheerful heart the vicissitudes of life. Fortunately, he did not add that this was what his own mother had done. If it seems a cruel letter to us, it must have seemed doubly so to the sick and frightened Mary Custis Lee. There's no recorded mention of her own reaction to his words, but I think it's significant that she never threw the letter away either. When Robert came home, he quickly discovered just how sick she really was. It took 9 long months after the baby's birth before Mary Lee was able to walk again, even with difficulty. As though trying to do penance, Lee threw himself into domestic activity, commuting between his duties at the War Office in Washington and the Arlington Plantation. He now began to spend as much time as possible with his daughter, curling her hair and sitting up all night with her, trying to relieve her croup. In the spring, the baby began teething, young Custis got whooping cough, and Mrs. Lee came down with the mumps, all at the same time. Overwhelmed, Lee acknowledged that so much illness and domesticity did not altogether suit a man of my nervous temperament. Fortunately, warmer weather and the children's improving health revived his spirits. The brightest flower blooming at Arlington, he wrote a friend, is my daughter. Oh, she's a rare one, and if only sweet 16, I would wish myself a cannibal that I might eat her up. Never again did Robert E. Lee question his wife's health or her need of him. As importantly, she never again let him know details of any illnesses she was enduring, and she never again asked him to come home to her. Instead, her letters sent far away to Missouri or Mexico or Texas carefully hid the debilitating rheumatoid arthritis that began to plague her in later years. Some Lee biographers have been highly critical of Mrs. Lee for not accompanying him more often to his various posts. A closer look reveals that she did go with him much of the time, beginning with his second tour of duty to St. Louis, where she made the arduous journey by train to Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Harrisburg, thence by canal boat to Pittsburgh, and finally by steamboat down the Ohio River to Louisville and St. Louis, along with her husband, six-year-old Custis, and the one-year-old baby, William Henry Fitzhugh, always called Rooney. Little Mary Custis, now dubbed daughter, to differentiate her from her mother, was left at Arlington with the grandparents. Though Lee was delighted to have his wife and two sons with him, Mary Lee did not find the year in St. Louis easy. The family quarters were inadequate, the heat and humidity smothering, the mosquitoes vicious, and the two little boys, especially Rooney, were a handful to control. I find it rather tiresome to nurse all day such an unsettled brat, she wrote to her mother, though his father has come to the conclusion there is not such another child in all Missouri. By winter, she found herself pregnant again, and she desperately wanted to get back to Arlington to have that fourth baby. But lingering river ice and a delay in Lee's emergency furlough kept the family from traveling until May of 1839. This time, the journey took 11 long, wearing days by steamboat up the Mississippi and Ohio rivers, then by bumpy stagecoach across Virginia from Wheeling. Mary Lee must have found every mile exhausting. Lee merely noted that she was much fatigued. The new baby, Ann Carter Lee, arrived on June the 15th, only 5 weeks after the party finally reached Arlington. There would be three more Lee children, and Mary Lee made sure that all of them were born at home. Her apprehensions about childbirth are not surprising, because in the middle of the 19th century, one in every 25 women in America died in childbirth. For his final tour in St. Louis, Lee went alone, even though he felt strongly that it has appeared to me highly proper to be as much as possible with my wife and children. Having the whole family with him again did become possible when he was assigned to Fort Hamilton, New York, to Fort Carroll, Maryland, near Baltimore, and when he was named superintendent at West Point. His tour of duty in the Mexican War and his time on the frontier in Texas in the late 1850s and early 1860s were hardly posts where he could take his, quote, nice little parcel of children, as he called them, which now included Agnes Robert E. Lee, Jr. and Mildred. During Lee's months fighting in Mexico, the family worried about him a great deal, including prayers for his safety in their morning devotions. For his part, he was grateful for every letter he received from home, and he longed to have his four girls with him to wrap up in my blankets each night. What a comfort they would be to me. When he returned home unscathed, the family welcomed him with open arms. Robert and Mary Lee had now been married for nearly 20 years. Old irritation seemed to have receded, and she appears to have felt only gratitude that he had returned to her safely. Juxtaposed against this seeming harmony, however, was Robert E. Lee's continuing practice of watching, taking pleasure in, and writing long letters to young women who were not his wife and daughters. If Lee was so contented in his marriage, what are we to make of the delight he seemed to take in young women like Eliza Mackey, Harriet Talcott, Martha Williams, and his obvious appreciation, quote, of the daughters of Eve who are formed in the very poetry of nature and would make your lips water and fingers tingle? And how did Mrs. Lee view the whole matter? Eliza Mackey was the sister of one of Lee's West Point classmates, in whose home Lee spent happy hours while stationed at Cockspur Island, Georgia, in 1829 and 1830 before his marriage. While Jack's mother fed him Georgian delicacies, Eliza charmed Lee with her bright eyes, and he in turn made clever sketches for her of turtles and alligators he saw outside his quarters at Cockspur Island. 6 months after Robert and Mary Lee married, they received an invitation to Eliza's wedding to a Savannah lawyer. Robert replied, congratulating his sweetheart and indicating that he was in tears at the thought of losing her. At the end of his letter, Mary Custis Lee added much more subdued congratulations. Harriet Talcott was a distant cousin of Mary's, whom both Mary and Robert came to know well only after Harriet married Lee's good friend and sometime engineering partner, Jack Talcott. The two couples saw a great deal of each other at Fort Monroe in 1831. Robert found Harriet charming and wrote her light-hearted letters always addressed to Talcott, my beauty, or my beautiful Talcott. Mary Custis Lee's letters to Harriet over the years were primarily about babies and child-rearing. The third young woman to whom Robert Lee wrote numerous letters was Martha Custis Markey Williams. Markey's mother had been one of three extraordinarily named sisters, Britannia, Columbia, and America Peter, all first cousins of Mrs. Lee, who had grown up in nearby Georgetown. America Peter had married an aide to General Lafayette, William George Williams, and the couple had four children, Markey, Kate, Lawrence, and Orton. When Captain Williams was killed during the Mexican War and his wife died soon afterwards, Markey was taken in at Arlington by the Custises and Lees. As Markey's brothers grew up and needed assistance in their professional careers, Lee helped Lawrence obtain an appointment to West Point, and he did his best to steer the more volatile Orton into a suitable career. To Markey, Lee wrote dozens of letters in the same courtly, bantering style he used while writing to Eliza Mackey and Harriet Talcott. Though Lee biographer Thomas Connolly is convinced that Robert E. Lee was in love with Markey Williams, I think Lee thought of Markey more as a fifth daughter than as any sort of genuine love interest. She, however, may well have been in love with him, though she must have realized that any kind of relationship other than that of an older friend and relative was impossible. 2 years before his death, she wrote to him, wondering if she'd ever have an opportunity to get married. "You must not say you will never marry," he replied. "It may be proper as well as becoming in you some of these years to marry." Eventually, she did marry a widower with several children. Historians have sometimes wondered not only if Robert E. Lee's billy-doos to Eliza, Harriet, and Markey hint at real or imaginary infidelities, but also whether or not Miss Mary Lee was bothered by the sweet nothings he scattered so widely. Her letters suggest that Mary Lee trusted her husband completely. she gave Robert a long tether, confident that he would always return to her and to the children and to the stability of home and marriage. Throughout their marriage, Robert Lee believed he had to take special care of his Molly. It's interesting to note, however, that when he was far away, Mary Lee seemed to grow stronger in character, even as her own health declined. After the death of her mother in 1853, she surprised husband and children by the way in which she returned to Arlington, found the courage to work out arrangements for her mother's funeral, and then took hold of the workings of the plantation, which Mr. Custis seemed totally unable to handle. During the years just before the Civil War, she became even more involved with management of the big house and farm, all of which Lee in Texas wrote her about in numerous letters, and to which she replied carefully and conscientiously. At the beginning of the Civil War, Robert E. Lee was even more concerned about her. How, he chafed, was she going to manage, expelled from her home and having to find refugee housing all over the state? I wish I could be with her, he wrote, to nurse her and care for her. But the frail invalid managed surprisingly well on her own. Between 1861 and 1865, she survived a week's occupation by Union troops, cared for, then grieved over and buried a daughter, and watched as wounded son Rooney was captured and carried off to prison. In the final days of the war, she became, for many Confederate women, an example of extraordinary courage and calm. Her home became a common meeting place, one young neighbor wrote. People came here to talk of victory or sorrow. They gathered here to work. The disheartened came for comfort. And she was still in Richmond when Confederate forces had to abandon the city. With only her daughters with her, she survived 48 hours of pillage and fire before occupying federal troops restored order. Sitting quietly and expectantly in her wheelchair, she welcomed her husband home when he returned to Richmond on the morning of April the 15th, 1865. "He's wonderfully well," she wrote a friend, "considering all he has endured." The last years of the Lee marriage were filled in large part with concern each about the other. He worried about finding an appropriate place for Mary and their daughters to live. She worried that he would not find the new work as president of a tiny college fulfilling. "I do not think he's very fond of teaching," she wrote to a friend, "but he's willing to do anything that will give him honorable support." Once settled in Lexington, he tended her gently, rolling her wheelchair onto the porch daily as neighbors watched in sympathy. For her part, she worried about his frequent colds and his increasing weariness. After his final stroke in October of 1870, she sat by his bedside and held his hand for days on end. And when he died, she wondered how she could live without him. "Now that the light of my existence has disappeared from my horizon," she wrote to a friend a few days after Lee's death, "the prospect is drear and gloomy. A few more years, and I shall go to him." Mary Custis Lee died little more than 3 years after Robert E. Lee on November the 5th, 1873. Now, finally, I'd like us to look at Robert E. Lee, the father, as seen through the eyes of his four daughters, Mary Custis, called Me or Daughter, Ann Carter, always Annie or Gentle Annie, Eleanor Agnes, early called, nicknamed Wig, but more often simply called Agnes, and Mildred, to whom Lee gave the unusual nickname of Precious Life. My daughters roll their eyes and say, "Thank goodness you never called us anything like that." All his life, Lee loved babies, and he warmly welcomed the arrival of each new daughter. As the girls grew, he spent as much time as he could with them, teaching them to ride horseback and to swim, taking them into bed with him in the early mornings to snuggle under the covers and tickle his feet. When he was away from them, he was inexpressibly lonely. "I'm very solitary," he wrote to them all in January of 1846. "And my only companion is my dogs and cats. You do not know how I have missed you and the children, dear Mary." He also worried about his daughters a great deal, especially Annie, who in 1844 had seriously injured one eye while playing with scissors. When he wrote his will in 1846, just before going into battle in Mexico, he included a particular provision for his gentle Annie, who, from an accident she has received in one of her eyes, may be more in want of aid than the rest. If children could only know the misery, the desolating sorrow with which their acts sometimes overwhelm their parents, he wrote, they would not have the heart thus cruelly to afflict them. Given the fun and excitement that his being in the house generated, it's not surprising that they adored him, especially the younger children. He was always bright and gay with us little folk, Robert Jr. remembered, romping, playing, and joking with us. When he was off in Mexico and Texas, the girls wrote him long letters, very pretty letters, he called them, about their studies and their garden plots and the pet rabbits, chickens, and cats they kept at Arlington. He's now in Texas. Oh, so far away he seems, Agnes confided to a friend. I love him so much. Replying to a letter from 11-year-old Mildred, in which she told him how big she had gotten, Lee wrote, 60 pounds. Enormous. I wish I had you here in all your ponderosity. At the end of that same letter, however, Lee could not resist giving heavy-handed advice. Mildred had spoken about how much she liked her pet chickens. He wrote, there's one reason you like your chickens. You attend to them and succeed. Try hard to be a truly good as well as wise girl and rigidly obey your parents and tutors. This preachiness was typical of his letters to his daughters and to the boys as well. The three younger girls did not seem to mind his admonitions. Agnes spoke for all three of them when she stated, we received such a precious letter from Papa. It was full of strong affection. Can I ever love my parents sufficiently or repay in any measure what I owe them? But Mary Custis was put off by her father. As she grew into her late teens, daughter began distancing herself from the close-knit family circle, staying for long periods of time away from Arlington, and not answering Lee's request to come home to assist her mother. Daughter is naturally dilatory in her movements, Lee wrote. She is as knowing and opinionated as her Aunt Anne, Lee's elder sister. I wonder what she would have thought of that. All the experience of others is lost on her. After the war, she was not at home when her father died, nor did she attend his funeral, behavior that Mildred Lee noted bitterly. Mary Custis, Mildred wrote, is always absorbed in self, first and foremost. Throughout their lives, Lee felt obligated not only to care about his daughters, but to care for them. This intrusion was deliberate and justified, he believed, because of his great love for them. Experience will teach you, he wrote to one of his girls, that notwithstanding any appearances to the contrary, you will never receive such a love as is felt for you by your father and mother. That lives through absence, difficulties, and time. When the war came and the girls scattered, he continued to feel this obligation to advise and see to their needs. He urged daughter not to stay in the northern neck with relatives, but she dilly-dallied, got caught behind enemy lines, and was cut off from the rest of the family for more than a year. He knew that the other girls, staying with Mrs. Lee at Rooney's home on the Pamunkey River, were also in danger of capture, and he suggested they move. When Mrs. Lee insisted on staying where she was to try to protect the property, they were all captured and had to be exchanged under a flag of truce. With Richmond overcrowded and unhealthy, he persuaded them to travel down to the Warrenton Springs Resort in North Carolina, where, sadly, Annie contracted typhoid fever and died. Robert E. Lee was devastated. To know that I shall never see her again on earth, that her place in our circle, which I always hoped one day to enjoy, is forever vacant, is agonizing in the extreme. Lee's most conspicuous fatherly interference came in 1862, when he seems to have forbade Agnes to marry Marquis's brother, Orton Williams. Agnes and Orton had been childhood sweethearts, and early in the war she had written him touching letters, worrying about his safety. Now, just before Christmas, in 1862, he arrived at the home where Agnes was staying to ask her to marry him. Handsomer than ever, with special gifts in hand, he might have expected to be received warmly. But the war years had changed Orton. His finely chiseled figure features had coarsened, perhaps from drinking heavily, and his always short temper had driven him to kill one of his own subordinates. At first, the visit seemed to go well, as the pair took long rides in the country alone. Then suddenly there was an unhappy confrontation in the parlor, and Orton stormed off alone. According to a Lee descendant, Robert Lee, though fond of Orton, apparently had withheld his consent, thinking him too reckless. The sad episode did not stop there. Feeling perhaps that he had to prove himself, the rejected lover embarked on some kind of spy escapade, which to this day has never been fully cleared up. Dressed in a federal uniform, Orton Williams, crossed Union lines near Franklin, Tennessee, was captured, tried in a midnight drumhead trial, and then hanged as a spy. When the news broke in Richmond papers, General Lee was incensed. I cannot trust my pen or tongue to utter my feelings. Marquis wrote to Agnes brokenheartedly, "You are very dear to me, dear Agnes, and ever will be. You seem like my little sister." But there are no extant letters in this period between Agnes and Robert E. Lee to tell what daughter and father were feeling. Certainly Lee's refusal to allow Agnes to marry was what many Victorian fathers believed to be within their prerogative. And perhaps Agnes herself realized that Orton would not have made a reliable husband. But we will never know if she harbored any bitterness against her father, or if she blamed herself in part for Orton's wild adventure. We do know that she never forgot him. In almost her last breath, as she lay dying in Lexington, she spoke his name. After Appomattox, Lee quickly resumed his role as arbiter of his daughters' lives, seemingly unaware of the changes in them brought about by 5 years of maturation as well as war. After all, they had nursed the sick, been subjected to house arrest by the enemy, and endured frightening days of fire and occupation without the support of brothers or father. But because he could find no peace in Richmond after Appomattox, he made the decision, alone, to move his wife and daughters to a small farmhouse in rural Powhatan County, Virginia, and later to Lexington. The permanent move to a small conservative college community was a difficult one for them all. A few days after their arrival, Mildred wrote to a friend, "Do you know what starvation of the mind and heart is? I suffer and am dumb." Within a few months, however, she had cheered up considerably as young men from the two colleges began to come to call, and there was established a cheerful pattern of social activities, all of which Robert E. Lee enjoyed watching. It was during the 5 years in Lexington that Lee acknowledged just how much Mildred meant in his life. "She is my light bearer," he exclaimed. "The house is never dark when she is in it." Busily, she set about to collect new hordes of cats and kittens. She attempted to learn housewifely arts. Lee teased her, occasionally unkindly, about her experiments with cooking and exploding ketchup bottles. And every day, Robert Lee and Precious Life saddled up their horses for rides in the beautiful, quiet countryside. Once they took an overnight ride to the Peaks of Otter. "At the top of the peak," she wrote, "we sat for a long time on a big rock, looking at the glorious panorama beneath, the Virginia he loved. He seemed to feel it with all his heart and was very silent. Agnes did her best to engage in the social whirl, but according to a Washington College student who had observed her that fateful Christmas when Orton Williams had come to visit, she seldom smiled now and appeared always to be looking beyond, as if she were still grieving for Orton and what might have been. Always quiet and efficient, Agnes was chosen to accompany her father in 1870 when he traveled south in search of warmer weather and improved health. When they returned home, Lee was a truly sick man. On the afternoon of September 28, 1870, Mildred was playing the piano in the parlor of the president's house when her father stopped to say he was going out to a vestry meeting. He didn't really want to go, he told her, for he hated to listen to all that powwow. And he commented on the doleful tune she was playing. During the days after his stroke, as he lay in a little army cot in the dining room, it was the silence that Mildred remembered. Because he was silent, we were silent too. When he died, Agnes dressed him in his one black suit while Mildred tried to comfort their mother. Agnes survived her father's death by only 3 years, dying on the same day in October that he had died. Mrs. Lee died 3 weeks later, leaving Mildred and her brother Custis to spend the winter alone, quote, in the emptied, silent house where every room echoed with dead voices. Some biographers have suggested that Robert E. Lee deliberately tried to keep all four of his daughters from marrying. It is certainly true that when they were out of town, even on short visits, he missed their love, care, and attention. But Lee cannot carry all the blame for their not marrying. The post-war years were not easy times in which to find a husband, because so many eligible young men in the South had been killed. Mary Custis was so independent that I'm not sure she would have wanted to submit herself to a Victorian husband's supervision. Annie was gone, and Agnes still nursed her wounded heart. It was only Mildred, 24 when her father died, who very much wanted to marry and have a family. There's little happiness, she wrote, for those who tread the pathways of life alone. She had been the daughter closest to Robert E. Lee, and his death left a void she was never able to fill. Most women, when they lose such a father, she admitted, replace it with husband and children. I have had nothing. So how should Robert E. Lee be viewed from the perspective of his mother, his mother-in-law, his wife, and his daughters? I don't think any of them would agree with the characterization by Douglas Althoff Freeman of Lee as a saintly, almost one-dimensional figure of noble simplicity. Because despite their silences, they must have been too hurt by him, too stung by his criticisms and teasing, too affected by his interference in their lives. Nor do I think they would recognize the marble man depicted by Thomas Connelly, whose icy self-control held in roiling passion. Because they knew Robert E. Lee to be open and loving, full of humor and playfulness. And what about Lee, the post-Civil War Confederate saint? Even though Mrs. Lee was enthusiastic about venerating her husband's name, and daughter Mary Custis was shameless in relying upon her father's international prestige, I don't think they or any of the women would want the inflated, lost cause icon to be the only representative of the man they loved. Because to them, accolades for his accomplishments, however gratifying, could not give a full picture of Robert E. Lee. Rather, I suggest they would ask us to see him as a very warm, very human, completely unique personality, a man who sometimes became irritated with family members, occasionally hurt those he cared most about, and too often intruded into their lives. In spite of, and perhaps because of, his faults and foibles, I think they would call Robert E. Lee a great man, great in his capacity for love, and even greater in his need to be loved. Perhaps Mildred expressed their feelings best when she wrote, "To me, he seemed a hero, and all other men small in comparison." Thank you. Thank you. Frank says if you all have questions, I can try to answer them. I wrote my book a good while ago, and most of my memory is up in the archive, so I'll do my best. Maybe that's it. Thank you.